multiple joint performance, but must everything be agreed upon? If you think about jazz duo performance, it is sort of like dialogue in some ways and sort of not, right? So it's two participants carrying out a joint action that is simultaneously a display for a listening audience, in many cases. And there's back and forth contribution of different content with constraints on what is allowable as in task-oriented dialogue. But unlike a conversation, you have simultaneous contribution by both parties over extended periods of time. And music doesn't have the referential content that is the heart of linguistic dialogue, right? So those are, there are many other comparisons one can make. So here I want to tell you about a line of research, and first a case study that started it and some a bit of later stuff we've been doing, where the aim was to explore the extent to which a pair of experienced jazz musicians understand what they have done together in the same way. Do they spontaneously generate the same descriptions of their performances and intentions immediately after they performed, individually, describing? When they don't spontaneously generate the same descriptions, do they agree with their partner's characterization of what happened and what was intended? Okay. Now, of course, we know that retrospective descriptions by a performer are not capturing all that is happening. They are an account of what is happening. So that's the caveat there. So our participants were a professional saxophonist and pianist who had never previously met. Both were male, one in his 20s, one in his 30s. Both had graduated from different leading jazz conservatories at different times. Both regularly perform in New York City. We paid them for participating. And the twist on this was that they never saw or spoke to each other throughout. They played behind a visual barrier in a performance space in New York City. This was because we wanted their interaction to be entirely musical, right? Not to have any immediate judgment about who's coming in and what kind of player they are based on their appearance or the way they walked or talked or to have a pre-discussion about how they might do it. We wanted it to be a fully musical interaction. This is a little weird, obviously, but the players thought this was fabulous and really delightful and great fun to do, very intriguing. It's also not entirely unlike people playing in recording booths and never actually seeing their partner or talking with them, which does happen as well. So it's not entirely an impossible situation. The task was, I'm sorry? Only the experimenters. And it was, so that's another difference in situation compared to, and a recording engineer who was taking care of the recording part. So the task was, we brought them into the lab and they improvised three versions of a standard. We told them, your task is to play three variants on this standard without talking to each other any time in between. There needs to be a space in between so we can tell when one has ended and another one has started, and they should be as different from each other as they can be. Okay? And we had a list of 9 tunes that they might feel comfortable improvising with an unfamiliar partner if they were a competent jazz musicians in New York City. The tunes were selected to be challenging enough to keep the interest of two good players through three interpretations, to be flexible enough to provide a range of improvisatory options, so having common alternate chord changes, not traditionally being played in a single standard key, and common enough so that both performers would be likely to be comfortable playing them. And there's a range on there. And we basically had them, gave them a list and had them circle the ones they'd be comfortable playing, and then we ended up picking "It Could Happen to You" from the list. The instruction was, again, the performances should be different from each other. They should last about 5 minutes with silence in between. And performers should never speak to each other at all, neither before, during, or after the performances. Okay, immediately afterwards, we whisked them off, and each player was interviewed separately by different interviewers about the three performances. The interviewer's task was to elicit detailed and specific commentary with as many statements clearly tied to specific moments in the music as possible, first from memory, and then while listening to recordings of the performance, as many times as they liked, with stops and starts controlled by the performer being interviewed, and with the interviewer watching the face of the performer while they were listening, in case they smirked at a certain moment and then didn't talk about that, the interviewer could say, right then, why did you make that face, right? So the prompts were, the memory prompts included, how would you describe the differences in the three performances you two just gave? Were there any moments that you had trouble playing together? Did you feel that someone was in charge and did this change during your performance? The prompts based on listening to the recordings included, what do you think worked and what didn't? How did you know what to do next? And what did you or your partner do that struck you as particularly interesting or notable? Okay. The interviews took about an hour each. We were audio recorded them for subsequent use. We also had a jazz expert invited him to provide written commentary based on close listenings to the recording, so we got yet another characterization beyond the performer's own characterization. So just to give you an example of what it sounded like, here is the first moment of ever playing together. And it starts circling around. The different versions were. Second time around, again, not talking in between. This time it is the sax that starts. Different. Expect the sax to come in, and the sax does not come in. Okay, so that's the okay. Okay, so from these interviews, we then and the jazz expert's commentary, we extracted 151 statements, basically every statement we could grab about the players, the performances, and their musical intentions. So there were 70 statements by the pianist, 34 by the sax, 64 by the jazz expert. There were 14 that were alternate versions of the same claim by more than one party, and 4 that were the same claim made by all three parties. We anonymized these statements and made them consistent to point to precise moments in the recording. So a statement like, I was playing a bass part, turned into, at about 4:08 in the recording, the sax plays a bass part. Okay. 33 statements were made about one performance, but could potentially apply to any of them, like the overall performance was standard or vanilla. 4 were general statements about all the performances. My partner's signals were very clear. And 114 were very specific and could only apply to one performance. Like, just before about 28 seconds, the sax was waiting for the piano to play the tonic as a cue to start the melody. Okay. All right, so part 2, retrospective rating. 2 months later, we had the performers listen to the recordings again and rate on a 5-point scale the extent to which they endorsed each statement. There were 4 sections of the questionnaire, general statements about the players and performances, statements that could apply to more than one performance that they rated for all 3 performances, statements about just one performance, and question about the experience of completing the questionnaire. Did you find yourself remembering how you felt at the time or thinking about how you feel about things now when listening to both? So the questionnaire ended up requiring 215 separate ratings of the statements about the performances, fairly onerous, but quite interesting for the performers, they reported, to go back and think about it. And you can see they have quite differentiated ratings all over the place on what they agreed and disagreed with. And in fact, we had room for commentary, but they were really specific. So here's at about 17 seconds, the piano changes the quality to Phrygian, signaling a more functional dominant. This is the jazz expert, not the performers. And the one of the performers says, I agreed, but it's more around 28 seconds. Right? So they were really listening closely, and they had really differentiated judgments. And for example, this person strongly disagreed with the idea that the pianist's opening was excellent on that third take. That was the pianist. And okay. All right, so really simple pattern of endorsement. Just people rating 4 or 5 on a 5-point scale these statements. First of all, both players most agreed with the statements they themselves had made 2 months ago, but not perfect agreement, but most of them. They agreed with fewer of the statements made by the outside listener and substantially less made by their partner. So right there already, there's evidence that one can agree with an outsider's characterization of what happened in a performance more than your partner's characterization. That doesn't mean it happens every time. This is one case study with one pair and one listener. But the fact that that can happen already goes against some musicians' intuitions about how a coordination works and what the mental states of everybody involved are. And if you sort the statements by who made them, which performance they were about, and what kind of statement they are, whether they're very specific or generalizable or global, you can see that they are all over the place in terms of which ones are fully agreed on, which have substantial agreement, and which have possible disagreement. The disagreements were about every kind of statement made by every kind of person about all three performances. Okay? So looking more closely at, we used Kappa, the statistic for inter-rater reliability, to look at the agreement between all the 215 ratings of every single person. And first off, thing to note is that the Kappas are in the low to poor area all over the place between the two performers, right? By all measures of Kappa, that's not very good. It's better than chance, but it's pretty low. And interestingly, in almost every case, the Kappas are higher between the sax and the listener and the pianist and listener than they are with the sax and pianist themselves. So that's another case where the agreement with an outsider can be higher than agreement with your performing partner. Okay, if we do a much more generous version of agreement, which allows when one person says neutral in the middle and one says positive, and say we'll count that as an agreement, and the same with the negative end, then we get beginning to be moderate Kappas, but again, mostly lower Kappas between the sax and pianist and between the performers and the outsider. Okay, if we start looking closely at the statements on which there was the greatest disagreement, there is a range of them. And so we became really interested in understanding what are they disagreeing on and why, right? So here's a case where when the pianist played in the same range as the sax at about 137, the pianist was stepping on the sax's toes. The sax fully agreed with that. The pianist fully agreed with that, and the sax entirely disagreed with that. Okay, so we started looking very closely at these. I'm sorry?
Okay.
Well, the sax was rejected all claims of toe-stepping, actually, right? So the question is, when there was disagreement, are they real disagreements, or is this just a matter of interpreting words differently and having a different idea about what's going on? So, for example, the claim was the sax player disagreed with, at about 221, the sax started a phrase on B flat, which seems pretty music analytic and pretty objective in a certain way, right? And did he disagree because he disagreed that it happened at all, that there was a new phrase, that the phrase started on B flat, or that it happened at 221, right? It's a complex statement with a lot of possibilities. Depending on where those dissents originate, we would come to quite different conclusions about this pair of shared understanding, right? So we elicited elaborations about the disagreements. We asked them, why did you disagree? We didn't say, why did you disagree? Why did you not endorse that particular statement? And that led us to reclassify the claims again. And we found some that probably, or possibly at least, are not disagreement and might just be a difference in interpretation of some words in the statement. So throughout this performance, the sax phrased in a way that made clear that the next chord was coming. The sax disagreed with that, and the sax elaborated. As we were playing each example, I let the piano establish the harmonic progression and chose to follow rather than lead. That may be a disagreement. It may not. It may just be a slight difference in emphasis. At about 138, the piano accompaniment is fragmented. Staccato chords in unpredictable places, some quite dissonant. The sax says, what seems dissonant to one person could very well sound beautiful and melodic to another. Taste is subjective. So that's a different idea of what dissonant means, where in a music technical term, it could be dissonant, but he was interpreting it as being a critique of whether it was beautiful or not. So we can rule those out. There's also a number of cases, in this case all by the saxophonist, that are pretty clearly ideological differences. So the... Let's see, the At about 2:21, the sax started to phrase on B flat. The sax says, "This seems like a very subjective observation. I could have used a B flat in my line, but who knows if I conscientiously made a move to B flat." The sax is the whole way through insisting there's no such thing as right or wrong in jazz, and that there any of these statements that are saying something went wrong, he just categorically denied, which is very interesting because there's other statements he made that absolutely suggest he believes some of the things he did weren't right. But nonetheless, in terms of these agreements and disagreements, he ideologically refused. So I'm not sure those are real agreements. They might. There's certainly a difference in what the sax player thinks it's okay to talk about when talking about jazz. But is that the same thing as really disagreeing with your partner? Maybe, maybe not. But there's a whole bunch left that, as far as we can tell, are serious disagreements and true disagreements about so the pianist time feel was rushed, said about that third performance. And the sax said, the pianist had a really great time throughout each of the three takes. At no time did I feel he was rushing. And the pianist absolutely felt he was rushing. So you can sort of go through statement by statement, and there are serious disagreements about the quality, particularly of that third performance, and about the responsibility for the trouble. So for that third example I just played, where the sax did not come in after the first verse, and it actually takes a whole nother round of piano verse before the sax then comes in, the pianist absolutely felt that he had failed to give cues that would have let the sax know it was coming and that it was time, and the sax absolutely believed the cues were perfect and he failed to come in, and it was his responsibility that that had happened.
Did he say he failed to come in?
He didn't use the word failed, but there's wordings he had here and there that suggested serious responsibility for it.
He was criticizing
himself, even though he said critique is not allowable, right? So because it's all yes and no but, right? So so what we're seeing here is less than fully shared understanding, right? So immediately after the performances, they did not generate many of the same statements to characterize their experience. In fact, fewer than 10% of the statements were ever generated by the same, had the same content in our judgment, at least. There were no statements that they both generated that weren't also generated by the outside listener. 2 months later, they endorsed their partner's anonymized statements notably less than their own or the outside listener statements. Quantitatively, the agreement with each other's ratings was at best moderate and only occasionally substantial under a very generous interpretation of what agreement means. And the agreement with each other is not strikingly greater than with an outside listener, suggesting they're not sharing privileged understanding relative to at least that listener. Okay, and again, this is a case study. Don't want to say that this is all jazz players all times with all outside listeners, but the fact that it can happen is, I think, notable here. So how important are these differences? You could see the extent of agreement as impressively high relative to the total radical difference you could imagine observing, right? In which case, then, the differences we're seeing provide a profile of each person's relative weighting or valuing of characteristics that they both agree with overall. But the differences are substantial enough on the third performance, on the quality, who was responsible for what had happened and who was leading, whether it was harmonically free and how enjoyable it was, that that seems more than just a minor difference. So this raises for us many, many more questions that this only is beginning to address. So would you get replication with other pairs with different levels of prior experience together, different levels of cultural overlap, with different outside listeners with different degrees of expertise in other genres, say freer jazz, notated classical music? What would be the effects of seeing each other and on playing live versus recorded? This was live, but if you're playing along with a recording that will not adapt to you, how might that change your concept of your partner? Is there less shared understanding in less collaboratively successful playing? Don't know. To what extent is the quality of collaboration impeded by too much focus on your partner's intentions? Right? So lots and lots of questions. We have started doing some next studies in this series to move forward on a number of different questions. So one is a study of the extent to which 239 listeners' judgments overlapped with the performers. Okay, I'll tell you about that in a second. With Amandine, we've done a replication and extension in free jazz with sax and piano, and we have collected data but have not yet analyzed a replication extension in chamber music with piano and cello. So I can tell you a bit about the first two, but not the last. Yeah. So in this listener study, we followed a selection procedure to get 24 statements out of 151, because we did not want to torment our listeners with 151 ratings. They wouldn't do it. eliminating overly technical statements that many listeners might not understand. So that didn't seem fair. At about 0.17, the piano changes the quality to Phrygian, signaling a more functional dominant. Maybe let's not put that out there for everyone to judge. And statements that needed previous statements to be understandable, we wanted them to be isolatable. So we had a set of rules and then randomly selected 12 statements that both players had agreed upon and 12 that they had disagreed upon, and never labeled them as such. We just selected those, okay? And there were roughly equal numbers of statements about each improvisation. So statements that performers had fully agreed upon, the overall performance was standard or vanilla. That was the first one you heard, okay? From about 2:40, the sax signaled the end of one chorus and the beginning of the next. Performers had disagreed upon. During these two choruses, starting about 1:22, the sax hears and uses the pianist's substitutions, and the pianist's opening was excellent, okay? And 42 of these statements were about the quality and character of each improvisation. So the rhythmic coordination between piano and sax was excellent. The piano's improvisation fit what the sax was doing. The pianist's playing was excellent. Seven are about the performers in general. The sax's signals are very clear. The pianist is open to doing whatever happens in the moment. And then we had additional questionnaire items about the listener's musical background and experience. So our participants were mostly musicians with jazz and non-jazz backgrounds. We had this idea that it would be fantastic to get a whole bunch of non-musicians in the mix, but it turns out this is an onerous enough task, and you have to like music enough to pay attention the whole way through that we didn't get too many non-musicians. There's also a viral moment when a whole community of people suddenly noticed it. So, so there was email invitations, there was word of mouth, there was an unintended Reddit post that we didn't put there, and then suddenly a whole bunch of jazz musicians joined. So we got 285 complete responses. We whittle it down to 239 after we filter out the speeders and the straight liners, the people who went so fast that they couldn't possibly have actually listened to the pieces the whole way through, and straight liners who just gave the same response again and again in order to get their reward. Okay, so once we take them out, we have 239. And here is what the sample ends up looking like. This is based on their self-reported musical experience. We have 213 musicians out of 239, 123 jazz musicians, 76 classical and smaller others who identified as rock, pop, folk, or blues, 89 pianists, 49 sax players, various others, 223 out of 239 who say they really love or like music, which I think is a sign of what you need to do to get through this, 189 who really love or like jazz, 157 with 5 or more years of daily playing, and 154 with at least some experience improvising. So it's a very particular sample of listeners, right? Not everybody, but maybe not so different from who would really listen to jazz regularly, right? It raises all these questions about how do you sample and recruit for a study like this. And self-reported demographics were 156 male, 89 female, with a pretty big range of ages, and a range of ethnicities, and a range of educational attainment as well. So the task was to listen to these three improvisations, provide ratings of endorsement, and it was expected to take about an hour, which in most cases it did. The idea was simply to provide endorsement ratings from 1 strongly disagree to 5 strongly agree, or 6 don't understand the statement. For each one, they could also have write-in comments, and we had them answer a battery of questions about their own musical experience and interests. So it was a Qualtrics survey where they had to listen. In fact, you can't advance to the next page until you have listened to the recording the whole way through at least once. They could go back and listen as many times as they wanted while doing the ratings, and the evidence is pretty clear that people really did listen again and again to make their judgment on whether they agreed with a particular statement. So, for example, these questions refer to music that starts about 1:22. And starting about 1:22, the sax takes 2 choruses. For some terms that we weren't sure who our population would be, we added some music analytic definitions in case people weren't sure what a chorus was, right? Or in case what a substitution was, okay? Which apparently I think some of the non-jazz players were very pleased to have access to, so they could think about those concepts. Okay, and we also had a whole bunch of just basic jury ratings, like the performance was artistically successful, the ensemble sounded unified, the interplay between piano and sax was excellent, to see to what extent there was consensus amongst the listeners on those statements. Okay, turns out there was no statement that was universally endorsed. Maybe that's not a shock. But they really did range. And so if we look at the top 3 most agreed on and the bottom 3 least agreed on. Most agreed on was that for the third excerpt, the pianist set the tempo. At about 6:10, the sax plays a classic wrap-up cliche, and the pianist continued the sax's phrasing at about 2:55. Least agreed upon was at about 4:52, the sax intended to play another chorus. When the pianist played in the same range as the sax about 1:37, the pianist was stepping on the sax's toes. And when the pianist played a solo line over the sax from 1:53 to 1:59, the pianist was stepping on the sax's toes. We could also look at which statements garnered the most don't know responses. Most don't know was in the last phrase the sax played, the sax was fishing to get out of the tune. These really do have a different quality, right, of compared to the other ones above, though exactly how to characterize that is our next task. But there are judgments about intention, right? And you can imagine a listener saying, I don't know what the intention of the player was, and also critiques of stepping on the toes. Unlike the last time, we didn't have a chance to re-interview everybody to find out exactly why they were disagreeing, but there are write-in comments that people made, and people did make them, and they suggest that at least some percentage of the time, the disagreements are really genuine. So, for example, the statement at about 1:57 to 2:03, because the piano does not pick up the turnaround, things are a bit discombobulated between the two players. One write-in comment was, sounds like they missed each other. The other says, it's not jumbled in any way, it's rather fitting. Exactly the opposite. At about 6:10, the sax plays a classic wrap-up cliche. Very cliche, too obvious. And I don't think it was cliche. It was a good mixture to it and signals the song was ending. Okay. At about 2:50, there was nice and memorable interplay. The two instruments clearly beautifully complement each other here. Timing was off. These are really different reactions to the same material. Okay, if we look overall at the endorsements, first of all, jazz players endorsed statements more often than not jazz players. Overall, there's also a clear effect that people endorse statements the two players had agreed upon more than statements the two players had not agreed upon. And those are two statistically independent effects and no interaction between them. Note, the listeners were endorsing statements the performers had agreed upon more, even though the statements gave no indication about the performer's level of agreement. That means there are some statements that listeners inherently find more possible to agree with than others, right? And the effect is the same for jazz players and not jazz players. What about inter-rater agreement between the listeners and performers? So now we laboriously calculated Cohen's kappa for every listener with each performer's ratings of those 24 statements and got a range of kappas, learned all about how kappa can be negative. We also then calculated 239 kappas between 24 randomly generated ratings and each performer's ratings because we wanted to know what do these numbers we're getting here mean, and how much, if you just had random numbers, would you get what kind of range of kappas? And we take the highest value of those random kappas with each performer as our cutoff for judging that any particular listener agreed with a performer more than chance. Okay, so that's our logic here. And that gives a really, to us, surprising finding that out of all of the listeners, only 15 out of 239 had any agreement with the sax player above chance by this definition of chance. And only one out of 239 listener agreed with the pianist ratings more than chance. Okay. Also not what we were expecting, but there it is. And this is the part we're still analyzing now, that ratings by the listeners reliably but only slightly fell in different clusters depending on whether they had reported being jazz players or not, and sax players or pianists. But the differences were really far from absolute. We still get the sense, based on the fact that there are clusters, that there are some different kinds of listening tribes, right? So that even if they're not agreeing with the performers, their judgments are agreeing with each other more than chance. But we haven't yet figured out what the key ingredients are that make those clusters meaningful, if they are meaningful. And we are aware that with all of the data we have, there could be spurious correlations that don't mean anything. So that's the next step on this. So here's what we're finding. Listeners are more likely to agree with characterizations the performers themselves agreed on. And insiders, the jazz players, are endorsing the performers' characterizations more than non-jazz players. But the general pattern of responding suggests surprisingly low levels of agreement with the players, and not universal endorsement even of seemingly factual music analytic descriptions. And it extends our finding that these two performers agreed with an outsider's interpretations more than each other's, that you get a very different pattern of agreement across people in how they're characterizing what's happening. We, again, don't know whether they are real. So the way we see this is about quantifying a range of interpretation across a listening audience. And letting us look at how different listeners' interpretations can be from performers and how different they can be from each other's. And some characterizations were more shared with non-participants than those they disagreed on. And the lowest agreement statements were about perhaps unknowable intentions and evaluations of imposition. But we are seeing, to our mind, a surprising level of interpretive variability. You could have listeners with very similar backgrounds interpreting the same performance really differently. What performers would classify as problems may not be heard as problems by listeners at all. That's probably a general fact about performance. We see a possible parallel with fiction reading. An earlier study in my lab found levels of agreement from 16 fiction readers articulating short story themes via Think Aloud, having really radically, surprisingly different interpretations of the very same material. Okay, I will move on. I don't have time for the free jazz story. The basic story is we got free jazz players this time who could see each other, and we replicated the former finding that people agree with an outsider more than with their partner. And we also find that with a different listener, they agree with the outsider less than their partner. So it seems like there's a range of different possibilities out here that we're beginning to quantify. There's lots and lots of questions about musical intentions, and I need to stop, but I want to conclude that the high quality of these performances, combined with the disparities in agreement, suggest that at least in this case study, fully shared understanding of what happened is not essential for successful improvisation. And the fact that the performers endorsed an outsider's statements more than some of their partners suggests that performers' interpretations aren't necessarily privileged relative to an outsider's. Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Michael. We'll move quickly because we have 7 minutes.
Oh, dear, sorry.
So.
And you'll pass the mic, so you'll be the first.
So thank you. I have a few things. I'm going to try and make them concise. One is a question for you, but something that came up all throughout the day yesterday is that most of the experiments that are being conducted, I hear that there is a very clear condition for the suggestion. So could you give them a particular song, familiar song, or with Ashley's is the same, or with the Lindsay Hope is the same, and I'm wondering, being completely naive within the scientific arena, is it possible, is it conductible to bring these two performers and not giving them any common page to start from?
Absolutely. That's what we did in the free jazz study, and that's the genre in which they regularly work. For this genre, it is regular that they will at least agree upon what standard they're going to perform in order to do it.
Yeah.
So that's sort of a basic of the task. So we could have had let them fully decide on it, but we wanted them not to talk with each other. Right?
Okay.
But you're right. There is an extra layer of coming to decision together.
Yes. So the other quick two thoughts, perhaps suggestions or questions. One is it possible, and what would be the meaning of bringing outside listeners that have never had any kind of experience with improvisation, and mm-hmm. how would that...
Absolutely. I imagine that there's going to be lots of different kinds of outside listeners. That's one of the reasons we did this listener study and wanting to get a range of people. My intuition is, I'm sure, matches yours, that there's going to be some people who are highly attuned to all sorts of back and forth of an improvisation in a genre they know about, in a genre they don't know about, I don't know. And whether people who are great improvisers in an entirely different genre will have closer matching with what the performers themselves think than someone who's never improvised, I again don't know. My intuition would be that, but we keep seeing less agreement in various places than we would have thought based on this method.
Yeah, and then a far-fetched thought that I have, because I feel, especially if we're coming from the same field as listeners or as like a control group or whatever, we have a lot of ego, we have a lot of information and education and layers of stuff that we are preoccupied with. What happens if we bring children, young children that have much more pure, perhaps, and clean understanding and interpretation of communication through two instruments? This is something.
It's a really good question. I don't know the answer.
Who's next? Ashley, please try to make your questions short now because we only have 3 minutes or 3.5 minutes. Maybe you should turn it on. You don't?
you said that the quality of performance was related to the more agreement.
Well, I don't. That's a speculation. It's a question. I have no idea. We can already imagine way more studies than are possible to do in one lab in one life, right? That would be interesting to do. And it's a speculation or a question whether, when improvisers are really in sync and doing a fabulous improvisation, will they agree with what happened more than with performances that are less collaboratively successful? I have no idea.
Okay, you can imagine
optimal level of disagreement may be needed in order for it to be good improvisation. Being too much together could lead to a really dull improvisation. What you really need is somebody bringing ideas you hadn't thought of and having a different idea about where we're going in the first place in order to make it right.
Yeah,
so there could be an optimal level of disagreement that is what leads to brilliant collaboration, improvisation.
You mentioned that one of your questions is whether or not they were collaboratively playing successful, if that was related to, because in the moment you could think they could have this yes and approach and be open and move forward in that way, but then maybe in the context of a post-session interview where they're asked to make judgments, that then they do think more critically about what's going on.
Absolutely, and I recognize, you know, this is a limit of any retrospective account think aloud method, and I fully acknowledge
yeah, I
that this is one
yeah.
one take on it, method. And there's other ways one could do it from, you know, and continuous ratings along the way through a lens is another method that has its strengths and weaknesses too, and it's hard to get at.
Cool, thank you. I really love it.
I'd like to query you a bit more. On your cognitive background assumptions and all this.
Mm-hmm.
Since this is on shared understanding, I'm referring to the joint production aspect, not to the audience aspect now.
Okay.
Would you think that shared understanding plays a role at all? A lot of people from the direct perception background who study co-regulation would say, okay, this works in real time based on what you perceive from the other person. And if their account is correct, you don't really need to build up shared understanding or engage into any kind of mind reading of what the other's middle range intentions might be and so forth. I'm not saying this account is true, but I'd like you to be more explicit on what the role of middle range intention mind reading
yes.
could be.
Well, in a way, our doing this at all was an exploration of trying to see how much there might be, and maybe there's none. You know, that's one actual possibility along the way that there might not be. I come from training in studying dialogue in language, where shared understanding of communicative reference, at the very least, is something that people want to achieve regularly. And one of my very first studies was about how eavesdroppers on conversation understand differently than participants, which is sort of I'm looking at a similar question in a different arena. But even in the language interactions. Literature, there is far less, there's a lot more that looks at whether people understood their references the same as each other than there is asking the question we asked here, which is, in a retrospective account of what happened, would we characterize the interaction the same as each other? And so that's a different question, and that's what this one is asking. And as far as I know, there's just very little evidence on to what extent people's self-characterizations align with each other, about what just happened, align with each other. It's just not a question that, in my world at least, has been asked often enough. I mean, I think what I like about this, I mean, there's things right and wrong about the method in all sorts of ways, right? One thing I like about it is it tries to honor and take seriously what the performers themselves, at least immediately retrospectively, think was happening, which a whole bunch of research regularly doesn't.
Of course,
I like that
this.
Aspect, but again, it's imperfect because self-report may or may not correspond to.
Let me be a bit more specific. The question is rather if this is epiphenomenal, actually, to the production itself. Of course, they could come up with shared understandings after the fact, but do they need these shared understandings to produce together? That was my question.
Yeah, and I don't know. I can say from people's subjective reports of what they think they're doing in various improvisations, and this is anecdotal rather than experimental, people believe that's what's happening at the very least. They believe that right here, I predict that this person is going to start another course, and so I'm stepping in right now. And, you know, in my own experiences in musical interaction, it has felt to me as if I am indeed making judgments about my partner's intentions. Right here, the singer is about to breathe, and I'm going to jump in this way. So it feels as if that's what's happening. Now, whether it's magically happening in some other way, I don't know.